Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Sex and Broadcasting, will play Thursday, October 13th at 7 p.m. Sex and Broadcasting is a documentary about the revolutionary independent radio station WFMU and its station manager, Ken Friedman. The film explores the question of how to do interesting, cool, culturally significant radio and internet broadcasting while being a sustainable institution.
I just want there to be a WFMU. I want WFMU to exist as a place where people can go who don't fit in, where people can go to find things that have been hidden.
Again, that's Sex and Broadcasting, Thursday, October 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the film screening Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson on Friday, October 21 at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Vietnam veteran S. Brian Wilson was run over and nearly killed by a military train during a nonviolent protest in 1987. Since then, he has not stopped calling attention to the endless illegal wars being waged by the United States. Again, that's Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson on Friday, October 21st at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The evening news is off tonight. Instead, we present the Columbus Day special of Rising Up with Sonali. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, reminding you that the last day to register to vote is Tuesday, October 18th, for the November 8th election. With an Oregon driver's license or ID, you can register online by following the links at sos.oregon.gov. That's sos.oregon.gov.
From Los Angeles, California, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Today is Columbus Day, a federal holiday that glorifies the founding of the U.S. at the expense of Indigenous Americans. To mark what many cities are now calling Indigenous Peoples Day, we'll spend the hour revisiting some of our best coverage this summer of the protests in North Dakota against the Dakota Access Pipeline. The movement to stop the construction of that pipeline symbolically captures the U.S.'s historic treatment of Native Americans, its routine violations of treaties, and the environmental racism of our fossil fuel industry. We'll hear first from Wiaka Eagleman. He's one of the founders of the original Camp Sacred Stone, who has been active since April. Then journalist Sarah Manning with the Indian Country Today Media Network will report on how water protectors were attacked by security guards and their dogs. Finally, American Indian activist and comedian Dallas Goldtooth will share his experiences at the protests. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. It has been nearly 5 months since an occupation in North Dakota to stop construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline began. But only in the past several weeks has the major national media taken notice. Thousands of indigenous people and environmental activists, led by members of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, have camped out near the Cannonball River. They're calling the space Sacred Stone Camp. And their effort to stop the pipeline has been met by heavy police presence and arrests. There have even been some reports of cell service being cut to the area. Still, the occupation continues to grow. The Dakota Access Pipeline was quietly approved by federal regulators, even as activists were celebrating the rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline. The Dakota Access Pipeline is only 7 miles shorter than Keystone. Today, we go live to Sacred Stone Camp to speak with one activist who's been camping there since April 1st, when the occupation began. Wiyaka Eagleman is a member of the Sichangu Lakota tribe. Welcome to the program, Wiyaka.
Hello.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, we're very excited to have you on. You're joining us from the edge of the campgrounds, where you're able to get self-service. Tell us, take us back to April 1st. What led you to begin this occupation? How many others were there with you when it first began?
Yeah, on April 1st, there was a call from Standing Rock Reservation to my people in Rosewood to come and set up camp here to resist the Dakota Access Pipeline. Our first camp was behind me on that hill over there. But due to the weather here, the wind, we moved down here by the river.
And we can hear that wind pretty strongly in our interview right now. So you've sort of had to move around a little bit since April 1st. But what prompted you, what motivated you to heed this call to come and begin this occupation in April?
This isn't my first battle. My first battle was Keystone XL. I was trying to run through my reservation, Rosebud. This is drinking water here. We get it down there too. All of our nations down south get it. Some water. You know, it's very important that I look after my future, or my kids' future.
And so, did you expect to stay this long and for it to grow this much? Today, I understand there's something like 2,000 people there?
Yeah, there's a little over 3,000 people. They come and go from all across the world. I didn't expect it to come this far, especially the construction. 70% of North Dakota's pipeline is already in the ground, 100% of South Dakota, and 40% of Iowa's pipeline is already in the ground.
And so this pipeline, which cuts across four states, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois, was approved by federal regulators, even though President Obama rejected the other pipeline, Keystone XL, that you also protested against. It approved, regulators approved this pipeline. So right now, what is the status of the construction? Have you and your fellow activists managed to stop it at least temporarily, at least for now?
Yes, we were on the front lines for a whole week straight, stopping the construction from doing any more damage to the land. Across the land, straight across over there, they still have their bulldozers and backhoes. They're still there. They're just waiting on the word from the Pentagon to continue with construction. As you see, way over there, right there, there is the second camp. It's called the Red Warrior Camp, and that's where most of the people are.
I see. Wiyaka, can you give us a survey with your phone that you are on right now of the land for our TV audience? My guest, Wiyaka Eagleman, who is a member of the Sichangu Lakota tribe, is at Sacred Stone Camp. He's showing us a view of the Cannonball River and this wide open sort of prairie land that the Dakota Access Pipeline will be going through. There is a campground with, he said now, 3,000 plus people that have been set up there to attempt to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. So my guest, Wiyaka Eagleman, back in his car now to protect himself and his camera and phone from the wind. Wiyaka, Can you link the battle that is playing out right now between activists like yourself and the U.S. government to history?
This falls back into the Battle of Bill Bighorn, Wounded Knee, of how the government is treating our people. You know, the land that they're on right now, it's sacred to Standing Rock. There's burial grounds, old rock cairns from back in the day. This company or the government knows where these are at because they don't live here. The people live here.
And in terms of the camp growing, tell us about how exactly other people have been joining you. You heeded the call from Standing Rock Sioux on April 1st, but I understand just in the past few weeks, other indigenous communities have sent their representatives. The camp is growing bigger. We've seen some dramatic images of, you know, people ceremonially coming in on horseback. Tell us a little bit about how the camp has been growing, particularly how other indigenous communities have seen this effort as part of a collective struggle.
It comes down to the first day when we started doing our blockades. There was only 10 of us at our camp here, and we put it out to the world to see what we were doing. We were resisting this company to come into the lands, and I think that's what got a lot of people's attention. There's people from all over the world that just showed up with solidarity and Standing Rock.
And for our TV audience, we have a video playing right now of the arrival of the Comanche Nation members that were greeted. There's a large bus load of people who have come in. How do they see this struggle, Wiaka, as a kind of broader struggle? How did they, I mean, this impacts North Dakota, South Dakota, it impacts the Missouri River, but why are, you know, First Nations people from Canada arriving here? Why do they see this as part of their struggle too?
You know, this, in my eyes, you know, this isn't just a native issue. You know, this is a good start as indigenous people to, you know, take all battles in hand. And, you know, I think it's important that all races of mankind come together, get together and see how we could work on each other's issues. This isn't the only battle right now. They can bring their struggle here and we can help them.
As far as you can tell, what is the breakdown of the activists there, indigenous versus non-indigenous?
There's over 87 nations represented here. As far as I know, there's more indigenous people than whites.
What has life been like at the camp, just in terms of practical issues? You've been living there since April. You're basically camping out for nearly 5 months. Can you tell, give me a sense of what the day-to-day life is like on the camp?
Day-to-day, you know, we try to have our wood and water stocked. We've held a fire, an open fire that's been lit for over 4 months now. We try to keep that going day and night, 24/7. You know, we take turns cooking meals. We take turns looking after the children. We sit back, we tell stories of, we try to learn the history of the land from the elders. We try to bring fun and humor into what's going on here.
And I understand the rules are pretty strict at the camp. No alcohol, no drugs, and that no weapons, etc. Is that true?
Yes, that's very true. We don't even let the tribal police in here. Behind you, we've got a pretty good security crew. They got it always fenced off. It's secured 24/7 too.
And what is that security crew's job? I mean, what are you worried about?
Infiltrators, people that don't know what's going on here, that just came here, that don't know anybody here, federal agents, news crews.
Why would you not want a news crew to come into the camp? Are you worried about the kind of news coverage that you would get?
Yeah, lately the local media has been putting false statements out there from the camp, saying that we are a violent camp. One action we had, our people, you know, we carry a sacred pipe with us in ceremony, and you know, we were just asking our people to pray and load our pipes, and the media took it and blasted it all over North Dakota, saying that we have pipe bombs here, loading our pipe bombs, and you know, so now the feds are going to get involved. But you know, they don't know the truth what's going on here. They're just all local media is doing that, and you know, it's very understanding that big oil companies are paying the North Dakota government to, you know, work against us. It's been that way for years.
What about the local residents in and around of the North Dakota area and where this pipeline will be going through? Because I understand that the majority of the pipeline will actually travel under private land. And so the company has been working with private landowners to get rights from them. But then parts of it, of course, go under the Missouri River. Do you see any solidarity from private landowners, or are most of them more than happy to let this pipeline through their land?
Most of them are, they're happy with what they got offered to them. You know, it's all about money to these landowners, especially where the buffalo roam on the north side of the river. Apparently, they don't care about the health of the buffalo, and we got eagle nestings around here. You know, we reached out to landowners. They did not cooperate. Some of them got forced into making their decision. They were either offered money or, you know, we're just gonna take your land anyway. You know, that's how this eminent domain works around here.
At this point, what do you foresee for the future of this encampment, Sacred Stone Camp? Now, for a few days, you said you were physically in the way of construction with the bulldozers, but now what's the camp's main goal? Is it mostly sort of symbolic to draw attention to the Dakota Access Pipeline?
We're trying to reach out to national media to see or observers to come and participate and see what's happening to these people. We started out with just our own local media, and it's, you know, it's just shot around the world, so we're still inviting people. This camp is always going to be here. You know, it's going to be up to Congress on whether they allow them to drill under the river or not. We got a website. It's sacredstonecamp.org. On Facebook, it's No Dakota Access in Treaty Territory.
Can I just ask you a personal question? You've been here since April. What has it been like for you? I mean, is your family here with you? Or if you have children, are they with you? How are you explaining that to your family, etc.?
Thank you for asking that question. You know, I didn't reach out to people on my personal issue, but it's been really emotional here for me because I lost family members back home, deaths. I lost my personal family. All I have left is my kids. Over the years, it's been tough, but I made a commitment to my kids. I'm gonna fight if it's for the rest of my life, for the safety of their future. And you know, I try my best to go home every now and then. It's hard. I don't have transportation. I'm still living oppressed, and you know, I still have a lot of feelings inside where I still need to take care of myself. You know, it's good to have friends out there that understand where I'm coming from, because you know, this isn't easy. It's not easy to live off the land. It's not easy to be out here in the open. You know, it's, thank you for asking that question.
How many children do you have? How old are they?
I have 5 children. My oldest is 8, 6, 5, 3, and 1.
And are they with you at the camp?
No, they're with their mother.
So you feel like your work, your presence at this camp is for their future?
Yes.
And do you think that they're all very young, maybe your 8-year-old grasps why you're there?
Yeah, you know, my older children, they know why I'm here. They've spent time with me at this other camp, resisting another pipeline. They know what I'm doing. It's just, I'm worried about my younger kids, the separation. And, you know, I really hope we stop this pipeline soon so I can go home and take care of my kids.
You mentioned earlier that all your life you felt the sort of government oppression. Can you give me a little bit more detail about that, a little example of that? Because I think it's important that this is not just one issue that a lot of Native communities are dealing with, but this is one of many issues and a long-standing history, right?
Yeah. You know, the government, they place us on these reservations. You know, we have like the poorest housing rate. They take away our language. They forced our parents into boarding schools where my uncles and aunties, you know, they were beat, they were, you know, molested in schools like that. And, you know, it just got passed down to my generation, where there's a lot of alcoholism growing up, living with, you know, no electricity, have to haul water, and also taking care of my cousins and my nieces. My generation, you know, we took care of each other. Our parents were never there, just our grandparents. And, you know, it was hard to understand how schooling went, because, you know, living out in a country like that, you don't trust anybody. You don't even trust your older relatives.
How old are you?
Yeah, I'm 28 years old.
So you feel that your generation, you've had to mostly look out for yourselves because of some of the systemic issues that have impacted your parents?
Yes.
So here you are at Sacred Stone Camp. Have you found community in the camp? Have you found, you mentioned people sitting around and telling stories and sharing oral histories from elders. Have you found a value to the camp beyond stopping the pipeline, but to your own sense of purpose?
Yes. You know, just spending time with the local community members, to see how they feel about it, sitting around an open fire and visiting with, you know, the new people and seeing where they come from. I think it's important to know how each other feels about what's happening in our lives right now.
Well, we will post those websites that you mentioned earlier on our website later today. Wiyaka, I want to thank you so much for sharing this time with us, sharing, you know, sort of your own feelings about your background and why you're there. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest, Wiyaka Eagleman, is member of the Sichangu Lakota tribe. He's been living at Sacred Stone Camp since April 1st, an encampment that has basically sprung up in opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our show on Free Speech TV weekdays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is available on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. The encampment at the Cannonball River in North Dakota to halt construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline continues to grow. Thousands of people are now present using their bodies to confront the state and the company doing the pipeline construction, Energy Transfer. The protest, led by the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, has attracted global attention, including solidarity from other U.S. and North American indigenous nations, Black Lives Matter chapters, and more. Activists see themselves as water protectors stewarding the Missouri River. In the past week, however, violence against protesters has sharply escalated. Last week, dozens of activists were arrested and many locked themselves to construction equipment. And over the weekend, media and activists documented numerous incidents of private security guards using trained dogs to physically attack and bite protesters. Joining me now is a journalist who was at the scene. Sarah Manning is a columnist and contributing writer at Indian Country Today Media Network. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, before we get into some of what took place last week with the arrests, let's talk about the most dramatic part of this story and the latest sordid chapter, which is how security guards used dogs to intimidate protesters. I'm seeing photos emerging of dogs with their mouths dripping in blood. It could only be human blood. And I should mention, Democracy Now! Did a very important special report from there documenting this as well. Did you see any of it happen?
I wasn't present on site, but I did arrive afterwards to interview a lot of people that were present.
And so what did you find happened? I understand that it wasn't just dogs, but pepper spray as well. Did you find anybody who had actually been bitten by these dogs?
Yes, I did actually speak to one woman in particular who was bit on the upper thigh, and I did an interview with her. I spoke to another gentleman who was maced in the face. But one thing as a side note really quickly that I want to just really emphasize is the fact that although this this presence of dogs, the mace, this is really kind of the event that has taken really pushed forth, I think, the amount of attention. However, this was not planned. There has been quite a bit of planned nonviolent direct action, such as what is taking place today. But yet this was something that was really a situation that had taken protesters by surprise, or I don't want to say protesters, water defenders. They were actually on a planned walk. Every single day, members of the encampment walk up to the original protest site to pray and sing, and they walk on foot. So they're actually walking on foot to go sing and pray when it was brought to their attention that this construction was taking place in an area where there were already some identified sacred sites and burial grounds.
So then the context of this was, I understand they saw bulldozers digging up earth that they knew was the site of old burial grounds, which of course are incredibly sacred to the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, as it would be to any community. And so that's when the security guards showed up with dogs?
Well, prior to this event, prior to this situation, it was police presence that was common. And so this is another reason why it was very surprising that there was this private security team of guards and dogs that immediately showed up on site. So it seemed as though they were prepared. The construction was taking place right near a fence side, right by the roadside where protesters could see. So many protesters expressed that they had seen police up on the hill and that they felt that they were baited. They obviously weren't prepared for the situation because they're women and children. And the first woman to cross the fence line to ask construction to stop actually had her young son at her side. So yes, it was bulldozers pushing earth. One woman stepped into the fence line and asked them to stop. A bunch of individuals were yelling, "Water is life." And then a gentleman, feeling that she was in harm's way because the bulldozers continued to operate, jumped in front of her, in front of the bulldozers, at which point he was tackled by a security guard. And that sort of what really escalated the situation and caused many others present to cross the fence line. After the gentleman was tackled by security, several other demonstrators crossed the fence line to take the security off of him. But this is where I think many, many people present felt that they were baited, because immediately arriving on the scene was the guards with the dogs, several dogs. They reported that although the majority of them were on a leash, one dog in particular was allowed to be off the leash and ran into the crowd. So several demonstrators there had to fight off the dog. There was horses present, and one horse was bitten as well. Six total people sustained bite injuries, and approximately 30 were sprayed in the face. We're not sure if it was pepper spray or mace.
And again, I want to recommend the Democracy Now! Special report, where you can see video footage of some of these incidents. Mm-hmm. And other activists who were present there also have been posting photographs online. We're seeing one, there was a female security guard in particular that was sort of letting her dog pull her towards the protesters who were gathered. Really remarkable scenes. And some people have drawn parallels between what played out over the weekend in North Dakota to what scenes of civil rights protesters in Selma, Alabama, when police unleashed water cannons and dogs against activists. So just remarkable to see that parallel. Now, Sarah, I understand last week there was a mass arrest, something like 30 people arrested, and that some activists, and I'm not sure what the coordination with members of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe is, and some activists, but I understand that some people are chaining themselves to equipment. Are these, as far as you know, coordinated actions? What are the dynamics within the activists around these forms of nonviolent civil disobedience?
Absolutely. Well, there are certainly a group of organizers that are trained professionals within the camp. There's nonviolent direct action trainings regularly, if not every day, every other day that I've been there. The nonviolent direct action trainings consist of environmentalists, civil rights attorneys, There's a legal team on site in numerous areas throughout the camp. There's the presence of trained professionals. But it needs to be distinguished, however, that the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is their own entity, and they're going about the legal side of things on their own. However, they're all working and working together in coordination with each other. But the arrest that took place last week, it was a planned, nonviolent direct action. Basically civil disobedience. So they're very well informed about their legal limits and their rights to demonstrate.
So Sarah, how far is the company, Energy Transfers, pushing the construction? Now we know that a large portion of the pipeline has already been built. This pipeline project was quietly approved, unlike Keystone XL pipeline, which was stopped in its tracks before ground was broken. This pipeline construction was in process, and there had been attempts to have illegal injunctions that the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe had requested the courts to do, but now it looks as though in various construction sites they're continuing in spite of the protesters. Is that true?
Absolutely. They're pushing forward very confidently and almost, I would even cross the line and say arrogantly. Actually, on Friday, the Tribal Historic Preservation Office identified a number of sacred sites and burial sites that were right near the fence line where the demonstration or the incident took place on Saturday. And so although Dakota Access was operating several miles back, they basically leapfrogged over to the site where the sacred sites and burials were identified. And so tribal leaders, as well as a tribal attorney and tribal historic preservation officer, believe that this was a calculated move that took place on a Saturday, which was strange. It was on a holiday weekend on a Saturday, and it did not allow for time for there to be an investigation into the presence of those sites. And so it just seems that the intent here from Dakota Access is really that of a bully at this point.
How important was solidarity from Black Lives Matter? I mentioned Black Lives Matter. I believe it was the Toronto chapter that some days ago arrived and had a delegation, and that there are even some people from Black Lives Matter Minneapolis present. And is this sort of solidarity considered to be very important?
I would say any act of solidarity is important. We definitely stand alone in many of our concerted efforts to protect the environment. And this is always who we have been. And while it's appreciated that many organizations, including Black Lives Matter, have chosen to participate, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a major turning point or a notable, you know, shift in energy. The energy has already been there, but it's definitely much appreciated.
And as far as you understand, what about solidarity from other Indigenous groups and tribes and nations, not just here in the U.S., but even in Canada? I understand that a lot of communities have sent representatives.
Yes, absolutely. As far as Hawaii, there have been representatives. I listened to a gentleman speak from New Zealand. There was a group from Canada. Numerous delegations come in representing tribal governments and then also individuals. And also locally within the United States, also representatives that identify as Mexica or Aztec from Mexico have arrived as well.
And so what is the plan going forward? As far as you know, what are communities planning to do, particularly the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which has, you know, been the one camping from day one? April 1st is when the whole thing started, and have really been the leaders. They are most directly impacted by construction of the pipeline to their burial ground, to their water supply. As far as you know, is the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe planning on staying there indefinitely? Do they have other events or actions planned that you can talk about in public?
I would absolutely say they are indefinitely in the fight for the long haul. I mean, this is their home, and I think people need to understand some really essential things, such as the value of water and our spiritual connection to it. And in the bigger context of things, I mean, water is so incredibly precious. So without a doubt, they're in it for the long haul. And as far as my understanding, the tribe continues to appeal any decisions if they're not in their favor.
And so is the tribal chairman, Dave Archambault, still banned from being present at the site? He was one of the earliest people to be arrested, and I understand the company issued an order restricting him from the site of the protest?
To be honest, I don't know how to answer that question. I wouldn't be able to confidently say yes or no.
And so at this point, do you think that the incident is getting enough national attention? And it's sort of sad to accept that it's only when people who are protesting are physically hurt and violence unleashed upon them that the national media takes notice. I've been seeing some articles in ABC about it. But do you feel that media coverage is increasing, even though, of course, the reason for the media coverage increase is not one that we like to see?
It's certainly increasing, which is hopeful. However, I do have the feeling, and many of us do, Indigenous reporters, people on the ground, feel that still the perspective is very slanted, and which is to an extent understandable. However, we're talking about a people here who have been silenced and whose narrative has been distorted and who, as a collective, have been villainized throughout history. And so although we're seeing some more mainstream media attention, it's really unfortunate that there still tends to be this focus on the moments of tension and hostility, really reinforcing this stereotype of the hostile Indian. And so I do hope that mainstream media does look back into the record of nonviolent direct action, of peaceful organization, of the daily prayer walks that take place every single day, the ceremonies that are occurring, the presence of women and children and elders into their late 90s. This is a peaceful protest. And so I think the focus on this particular event that took place this weekend, while it is, you know, it's great that it's gaining attention, I think it should just be it's just such a sliver of what's taking place.
Right. And I understand that the rules at what's called the Sacred Stone Camp are very strict in terms of no alcohol, no weapons, no drugs. They've been very strict about that for this very reason, to make it really clear that this private company and that the government would have no reason to tarnish the activists with any violence coming from them. It certainly seems as though all of the violence involved in this particular incident, as it's playing out, is coming from the private security guards that the company is hiring, as well as from the state. And actually, let me ask you about that, Sarah. How strong has police presence been? State police, as well as any sheriffs that have been present? Are you seeing strong police presence protecting the company from the people who actually live there?
They're definitely there to protect the company. Mm. To be clear, there is no police presence down at the campsite. The police have a barricade established on the highway that's redirecting Native American traffic, where they're essentially sorting by color, not allowing Native American people past the barricade to travel between Bismarck South into the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. However, they are allowing non-Native people that are going to the camp, which has been interesting. And they are also allowing local residents to get by. And so what that
Wait,
is
so
doing
they're,
is essentially...
They're actively racially profiling against Native Americans,
yes,
trying to get it,
yes,
passed? Wow.
Yes.
That's an,
So
that's...
the Native Americans have to take a detour, which is about an hour out of the way, in order to get to the camp from Bismarck, North Dakota.
I mean, so many of these things that are playing out right now seem to be a replay of colonial attitudes towards Indian people. Would you say that that's true, that this fight beyond the pipeline itself has a much broader symbolic aspect to it about the disrespect of treaty rights, etc.?
Yes, for sure. And I think those parallels are very clear to us, very clear to the Indigenous community and other communities of color. However, America at large is very ignorant by design about colonialism and the impacts of it, because the majority of American citizens are beneficiaries of colonialism. They benefit from it, while the people of color, we continue to suffer. So I don't think it's a parallel that the dominant society draws immediately. However, for us, as a historically traumatized people, it touches nerves. touches nerves that basically incite that fear. We don't have a faith in the police officers. Nobody feels that the police are on our side at this point. When the dogs were present, people immediately were terrified. We thought of back in 1493 in Columbus's second voyage, he brought war dogs to exploit the Caribbean and to kill and subdue the Taino indigenous people in order to extract gold. And here we see Dakota Access bringing these aggressive dogs that have bitten women and children. And in the name of oil. So absolutely, there are parallels that go beyond the civil rights movement that touch directly our community. And that's what I think is really traumatizing for us. And I think, again, that's one of those essential understandings that the dominant society does not have, which is really necessary in understanding all of the emotions that are tied to this struggle.
I really appreciate you bringing up that even more appropriate reference to the use of dogs. Sarah, where's the best place for our audience to read your writings on this particular story?
I contribute my stories at Indian Country Today Media Network, and it could be accessed at IndianCountry.com.
And we'll post that link.
IndianCountryToday.com. Sorry about that.
IndianCountryToday.com. We'll post that to our website later today as well. Sarah, thank you for all your contributions and for spending this time with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sonali.
Sarah Manning is a columnist and contributing writer at Indian Country Today Media Network. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can watch our TV show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. The Morton County Sheriff's Department in North Dakota has begun charging activists protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline with felonies. Five people were charged this week with reckless endangerment and two with conspiracy to commit reckless endangerment. It's the first time since the protests began that people are being charged with more than a misdemeanor. Many have actively risked their safety by chaining themselves to bulldozers to stop the pipeline construction. Private security guards last week unleashed dogs on protesters, resulting in several people being hospitalized for bite injuries, but there have been no charges so far against the security guards for endangering and attacking protesters, despite clear documentation of the confrontations. The months-long protests began in April, but only started receiving media attention in the past several weeks. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has led the movement of what they call water protectors, who seek to protect their collective water source, the Missouri River, from the pipeline. My guest is Dallas Goldtooth. He is the Keep It in the Ground campaign organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network and a member of the sketch comedy group, the 1491s. He was recently profiled in the Los Angeles Times. Welcome to the program, Dallas.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now, you were very active in the Keystone XL pipeline protests as well. And there was, of course, a very clear victory in that project when President Obama essentially refused to approve it. And there has been what people think at least partial victory in the Dakota Access Pipeline, with the DOJ and the Army Corps of Engineers asking the company and the DAPL pipeline to voluntarily stop. First of all, what is the latest status on the Dakota Access Pipeline, as far as you know?
Well, so it was a partial victory. I think that was a momentary victory when the three agencies made the statement that they're going to stop construction underneath the river. That's a blessing. I think that's a great acknowledgement of the great work that we've done on the ground. I think that's an acknowledgement of nonviolent direct action, of solid mobilization, really good grassroots organizing. I think it's a good sign. It's not a win, but it was a demonstration that we are winning in this fight against Dakota Access Pipeline and to protect Mother Earth. Construction, there was no construction to begin with underneath the river at this point. So when the federal government halted, you know, any permits or any construction. It's great, but that it doesn't stop the construction that's happening on either side of the Missouri River, where they're still trying to put pipeline into the ground. So, you know, the statement that they put out there, it was nice, but, you know, Dakota Access, don't be fooled, is still putting pipeline into the ground, trying as much as they can to get all the way up to the federal lands where, you know, the statement says that they can't dig any further, but they're going to do their very best to try to get as close as they can. And so, you know, that the lay of the land right now is that water protectors, land defenders there within the you know, Dakota Access resistance camps are dedicated to use nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience to halt construction as much as possible.
And let's talk about that activism and the nature of it. There have been many people who have really risked their own personal safety in climbing up on the bulldozers, chaining themselves to the bulldozers. Now, as I mentioned, there is a group that is facing felony charges. I mean, this could be tens of thousands of dollars in fines and possible sentences of years in prison if they are convicted. What do you think this represents for authorities to start charging people with felonies?
Well, we've already seen an inappropriate escalation by the law enforcement, by the very fact that they've brought in the National Guard, and that that in the past couple of arrests that they've made, they've had police officers on site with semi-automatic rifles to deal with water protectors who are unarmed, who are merely there to an act of civil disobedience. So we've already seen this absurd escalation of law enforcement reaction. We've seen this escalation of Dakota Access bringing in security, their own private security force, with their own attack dogs to sic on unarmed protesters, unarmed water protectors, and the usage of mace upon, you know, a crowd of women and children and men. So it's absurd. And so it just add to it now, you have the court system, who is escalating their own form of absurdity by pushing for felony charges. And the thing that's really crazy about this is that what the charge that they're advocating for is reckless endangerment, because they're stating that police officers are put in danger when they're trying to remove water protectors who are locked down, who are chained to machinery. So there's no really consideration of, like, the danger that the water protector themselves may be in, or any consideration that, you know, that this entire pipeline is considered a reckless endangerment to entire communities